Hi, and welcome to Recovery Internet Radio and our show, Straight Stuff on Addictions. Our tag tonight is Peaceful, Calm, Quiet, A Nun's Journey. And our guest is Bequeny. And I want to thank you for joining us tonight, where we are every Sunday night at 8 o'clock. Thanks to our engineer and sidekick, and I think recently added the producer to that title.
That's pretty good, yeah.
All in all, Chris Atwater. The name, if you know my name, you know that that name is very similar to mine, which might give you a clue.
Yeah, we were talking about that last week. We don't usually mention that on the show, but yeah, it's... Yeah, we, a son team here.
Yeah, we kind of outed ourselves last week on that. So, and we want to thank the provider of our intro music, Brendan O, which we do every week. And this week's show is pre-recorded, so there won't be an opportunity for you to call in, although there usually is. And the call-in number, just for future reference, is 323-792-2977, or you can tweet us at Rick Atwater. Remember to check us out at recoveryinternetradio.com. That's
recoveryinternetradio.com. And if you have questions about this show or any others, you can always get a hold of us. There's an email contact in there, so
yeah.
Please give us a shout.
You can go to that website for all the archive shows. There's also some resources and contacts and other things that you might find interesting. Just a couple of mentions. We want to mention. Are you gonna plug in the Rose commercial when we? Okay.
Yes, I will.
So we won't do that. I want to mention our friends. Some friends of ours that are musicians. Their band is called Double Take, and you can go to doubletakechicago.com. If you want to know what their schedule is, they're always fun. They're a dance, rock and roll dance band, and they play in the Chicago area, and they're a lot of fun to listen to. So we hope that you listen to them. And then we also have some friends who do cards for recovering events, Dirty Laundry Designs.
Yeah, those are cool.
Yeah, they're really cool. And you can contact Colleen at dirtylaundrydesigns.com.
Easy to remember.
Or by calling 815-245-1209. That's 815-245-1209, Dirty Laundry Designs. And we also want one final shout-out here to our friend Dr. Tom Franz at Franz Chiropractic. He's a good buddy of ours, and so if you need chiropractic care, that would be a great place to go. I don't have his phone number with me, so we'll have to plug that in later.
Just look up Franz.
Dr. Franz. Okay, I think we're ready to go. And I want to thank you for coming. And, well, actually, for us for coming.
You came to me.
Because we came to you.
Thank you.
Bequeny. And it's a pleasure to be able to talk to you. And we appreciate your willingness to be a part of this.
Well, it's a pleasure for me, but I'm a little nervous, so I'll just go with the flow.
We'll go with the flow one way or the other. So the first question I have is, we're in a place called the Blue Lotus Temple right now. Can you tell us just a little bit about the temple and what its focus is?
Okay. Well, we're in the basement of the Blue Lotus Temple.
So this we're not
is
actually
a,
in the
this
temple.
This is a part of the building that has not been reconstructed or updated. We've met in this building for the last 10 years, and we actually met in the basement, in the room we walk by, the big room we walk by. And this was the Unitarian Church, the Universalist Unitarian Church of Woodstock, and had been for, the building is over 100 years old.
Had it been the Unitarian Church that whole time?
I think it had been different churches, but the longest tenant had been the Unitarian Church. Mm-hmm. So we met here the way other community groups did, in the basement. And when the church decided to sell the building because they are moving, they moved to a different spot in McHenry County, they offered us this building. They sold it to us.
Hmm.
And we had been looking for a building or looking for a space originally to build. Then we were looking for a building to buy, and then this one presented itself to us.
You were here already.
We were here already, and it was home for us, mm-hmm. and we really had been welcomed in the community over mm-hmm. the years. So we bought the building and spent the first 6 months reconstructing the upstairs.
Mm-hmm.
So we kept those beautiful stained glass windows mm-hmm. that were part of the church's history, and built a Dhamma hall and a office and a bookstore and library.
Can you explain what a Dhamma hall is?
Well, Dhamma, we call it our Dhamma hall. Dhamma means teachings or the truth,
mm-hmm.
and that's our meditation hall. So mm-hmm. that's always set up as a quiet space where people can go to meditate.
Mm-hmm.
And we have our Saturday and Monday evening. We have all of our meditation sessions in that large room. So we have chairs and cushions, and someone can come in anytime the building's open and sit mm-hmm. there and
okay.
and be have quiet.
Are there scheduled meditation times for group meditation?
There are. We have our largest groups are Monday evening
mm-hmm.
at 7 and Saturday morning at 10.
Mm-hmm.
Those groups we have now around maybe an average of 50 people at each session.
Okay.
So we've grown quite a bit. We were getting that big when we were down in the basement, but we've grown since the building has been open. We had our grand opening. I really didn't like that phrase, but so our opening ceremony was in May, and we had that along with our Visakha Day celebration.
Can you say what that is?
Visakha Day is in Buddhist cultures. Visakha Day celebrates the birth of the Buddha
mm-hmm.
and his enlightenment that he reached after many years of searching. And then it also celebrates his death, which we talk about as the final enlightenment,
mm-hmm.
because he lived another 40 years past the time he was enlightened, mm-hmm. so he could teach and
mm-hmm.
teach the Dhamma to people who were interested in it. So it's a big, in Asian cultures, Buddhist cultures, it's just a big, wonderful holiday. It's like Christmas and Easter and, you know, the 4th of July all combined.
All combined.
So we do it in one day, and
was it just recently?
It was in May. It was the end.
Oh, in May.
We celebrated at the end of May.
Okay.
But what you'll find here in this country, different Buddhist temples pick different days to celebrate it,
mm-hmm.
and then they are able to invite people from other temples to come to their celebration, and monastics often will go be invited to be part of the ceremonial part.
Mm-hmm.
So there might be the month of May. And might be Visakha Day celebrations
all through the month.
Right.
And what would you say is I don't know if it's the right question to ask, but the focus of the temple here?
Well, the focus for us is basically our meditation practice, and it's also the development of a community,
mm-hmm.
which in Buddhism we call our noble friends, or other people who have the same motivation, the same goals, the same thinking about things. So there are noble friends because those are the people we can go to get if we need advice, if we need wholesome company,
mm-hmm.
you know, just a similar thinking.
Okay.
So we're developing a community of people. And we're also offering that place where they can come for their spiritual practice, for training in the meditation practice, which is really the basic, most basic part of Buddhism.
It seems like you've done pretty well at that.
I think so. I think Bhante Sujata, who's the abbot,
mm-hmm.
but also the founder, the monk who started Blue Lotus back 10 years ago,
mm-hmm.
he has an amazing personality and an ability to connect with people.
Mm-hmm.
People really feel like they connect personally with him.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been a big, big part of it.
There is two questions. We were talking a little bit before the show about Bhikkhuni.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say a little bit of something about your name and then your full, how you would be addressed, your full name, and then?
Oh, okay. Bhikkhuni is actually would be the same as a title. It would be Bhikkhuni means a female monk.
Okay.
So I'm a and I earned that title when I took my full ordination, mm-hmm. which for me was about 2.5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So that
there aren't too many of you, are there?
There aren't very many of us in the West or in the world, for that matter.
How many do you think?
In North America, maybe in the Theravada tradition, which is the monastic tradition I'm in, there may be 20 in this country.
Okay.
And Westerners may be 15. So not many. So I'm the only one in this area, which is why I don't live in a monastery, because there just aren't monasteries for Buddhist nuns in this country.
Pretty small.
Yeah, it'd be very. But yeah.
Yeah, a monastery for one.
That's what I live in. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm very connected with the monks here at Blue Lotus, mm-hmm. and there are three mm-hmm. monks now. So we're very much like a family.
Mm-hmm.
And the monks live here next door to the temple, and mm-hmm. I live in Wisconsin,
mm-hmm.
which is why we have meditation groups in Wisconsin.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Yeah. Those are the ones that I lead.
And so Bhikkhuni is your title.
That's my title.
And then you mentioned that
my Buddhist name is Wimala.
Okay.
Which was given to me by Bhante Sujata. And then that's the name that I've kept through the ordination process.
I see.
So Wimala is a Pali word that means clarity.
Hmm.
And Bhikkhuni means female monastic.
Hmm.
So people will call me all different things here at Blue Lotus depending on how long they've known me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, was it before I was ordained or after?
Uh-huh.
And the more proper title, if we were teaching people especially how to relate to the whole Buddhist world, would be to call me Bhikkhuni.
Mm-hmm. So that's a great, that's how you introduce yourself to me, and that's
right.
how I know you now, so... That was a good teaching.
Right.
Say a little something about the tradition. You mentioned the tradition that you were ordained in.
Yes.
There's obviously other traditions.
The two main traditions. So the Buddha began in India. That's where he lived.
Mm-hmm.
And Buddhism is much less in India now because it was kind of wiped out over time. But as he ordained monks and nuns and kind of sent them off, there were people that traveled into China, and there were other people that came a more southern route, went into Sri Lanka, Burma, Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
So the ones who kind of took that more northern path, now those are the traditions we call Mahayana.
Mm-hmm.
So that would include China, Japan, Tibet, and into Vietnam
mm-hmm.
and Korea. And then the southern route was that's the Theravada group. And so that's based more in Sri Lanka, Burma, Thailand, and right up to Vietnam.
I see. And that's the tradition.
And that's the tradition we are.
Okay.
So there's very little in terms of essential Buddhist teachings, very little difference, but culturally there's a lot more difference, and there are some different concepts. So the Theravada tradition is very much based on the Pali Canon, which are the original teachings that were memorized and then written down.
Mm-hmm.
The Mahayana tradition has picked up teachings from teachers along the way. So their teachings, they have teachings from a more recent mm-hmm. strain of teachers.
Yeah, as you explained it when we talked before, I showed you the question, kind of like Methodists and Lutherans. That might be a little of a tacky description, but
that's a description I probably use too. It's a little bit like maybe different denominations.
Okay.
But there is a real effort, especially in this country, to really connect all those.
Oh, okay.
So there are a lot of because we have all of that in this country, we really try to connect with each other, and I think because we don't have countries that are, this is not a country that's all a Buddhist country, you know, so
right.
you see a lot more interaction between Zen and the Vietnamese temples in Chicago are always We connect with them a lot with our celebrations. They invite us to theirs and they come to ours. So we see a lot more connecting, which is a really positive thing, I think. The differences are so minor. They're very much more culturally based.
I can see why you'd want to connect, because the community isn't that large.
That's right.
Yeah. So maybe we can. Yeah, I kind of want to get some have some background for people to understand where we're coming from. And now maybe to switch gears to be a little bit more personal with you and ask you, where would you say your spiritual journey started? How would you describe the beginnings of that?
I was raised in a very, very fundamentalist, conservative family in the
Texas,
South.
You were from Texas.
Right.
We talked about that.
Yeah. And when I left to go to college, I left that church, and that was the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So my first experience was to be very grounded in that fundamentalist church, and then knowing that I was leaving that, and then that was the beginning. So several years I didn't want to have anything to do with any kind of religion or spiritual path, and that I only saw you were either one thing or the other, and then that proved to be pretty unsatisfying for me. So after about 5 or 6 years, I became interested in looking at different paths and studying different things. I lived in California for a long time, lived in Japan, and over the years just...
What took you to Japan?
I went there to teach English. And
oh, you did?
One of my brothers was living there at the time, and I visited him. So I was there for 3 years. No interest in Buddhism at the time, but I had made some different journeys into different spiritual paths.
What did you look at there?
In Japan, nothing.
That was
very much interesting culture, and I love the temples, but I wasn't drawn to that at the time. And then at one point when I came back from Japan and I was married and had my two children, at that point I went back into Christianity. And I went into a liberal congregational church in Wisconsin. And I really felt like that was really important for me. That was where I really healed from that
more fundamental approach. Yeah.
And I was very involved in that church. And that was a really good experience. And then that became, I don't want to say not enough, but it was clear to me that was...
Would you have ever dreamed? I mean, this isn't on the list, so I warned you. But would you have ever dreamed at that time that you would be where you are now?
I mean, no, because it was at about that time that I started, going to meditation in Milwaukee, and it was also during that time that I started becoming involved in 12-step programs.
Mm-hmm.
So I was doing all of that, and I think for me at that point it was more just dealing with issues going on in my life. And I had been I was trying for a while to hold the Christianity thing together, and the 12-step part was working, and then I started coming to meditation in Milwaukee, and pretty quickly started to shift that the meditation was what I've been looking for.
How did you find that meditation in Milwaukee? Was it a fluke, or did you have a friend?
It was with a friend, but it was a fluke to find that center. There was a teacher that some Japanese friends of ours had said, if you ever can meet this Tibetan teacher, if he ever comes to America, go and listen to him. So we found out that particular teacher was coming to Milwaukee.
I see.
To the Shambhala Center. And we'd never heard of the Shambhala Center, and neither one of us had done meditation, but we went to hear that particular teacher and stayed for a retreat he was doing, and at the end of the weekend asked if we could take the precepts to become Buddhist. So it was really like just something cracked open.
Just
fell in place.
Just fell in place.
Right.
Yeah. You were still living in
in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And I still am in that same area.
Mm-hmm.
So about it was about an hour from Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm. And you're still living with your husband and kids?
No, I can't be a nun and be married. So, mm-hmm. but right, that was there, during that period was my making a decision mm-hmm. about my marriage, and
mm-hmm.
I did get a divorce. So mm-hmm. my kids and I stayed right in that same area,
mm-hmm.
you know, right in their same school district, and close to their dad. And even at that point, I never would have dreamed I'd become a Buddhist nun. That was not that was not in the cards.
It wasn't in the plans at that time.
No.
Does anybody plan for something like that? I don't know.
I think it doesn't happen that way. I think it's just kind of a suddenly the idea comes into your head or presents itself some way, and then it may just be. You know, where I was in my life when it became something I thought about was when my kids were going off to college, and then I realized, well, that's a possibility. That's probably something that I've thought about without knowing I was thinking about it. Idea.
Yeah, that was back there somewhere. You know, like I know in big Catholic families, you know, this is grossly stereotypical, but you know. This one's going to be a cop, and this one's going to be a fireman, and this one's going to be a priest. We got to have, you know, probably got to throw a lawyer in there somewhere. You know, I don't know if they...
That didn't happen in my family.
That wasn't the way. I don't know if that's the way it is in Sri Lanka when you're. We're going to have a nun. I don't know.
Maybe.
But not here.
Not here.
Yeah. So anyway, that kind of came out of the blue for you.
Well, it did, and I had been going to Shambhala Center for 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then I saw a little note in the library or the post office where I live that this Buddhist monk from Sri Lanka was coming to teach a meditation class.
Mm-hmm.
And that was undreamed of. That would never have happened even a few years before. And
why is that?
Well, in Wisconsin at that time, which was 7 or 8 years ago, there just weren't any meditation groups.
Oh, okay.
Or Buddhist groups.
Yeah, just
right. Just not. And he was coming to teach the class at a yoga studio literally about 3 blocks from my house.
Huh. Huh.
So, and it turned out the people who had arranged for him to come were people I knew pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
So they had been coming here and met Bhante Sujatha, and that was in the early days of the basement
year. Who came to teach the class?
He's the one who came to teach the class. His schedule was still open enough, and he wasn't as busy as he is. It was amazing. So I lived really close, and I was really interested in going to all the meditations, and my schedule on Saturdays was open. So pretty quickly, I became the one who unlocked the building and set the cushions up, and then I'd bring some tea. And if he got there early and I was early, he would sit and we'd have tea and talk. And so I really had a great opportunity to get to know him pretty well.
Okay.
And so it was within that first year that we started talking about it.
And at the time you're describing, are you still living in your family situation, or are you already by
now?
No,
family situation. I had been divorced about 10 or 12 years at that point.
I see. Okay.
Yeah, and my kids were, one daughter had graduated from high school, and my son, my youngest, was in his last year or two of high school.
What do your kids think of what you're doing? How do they?
They were, Bhante, in my situation, usually if you ordain to become a monastic, your parents have to give permission.
Mm-hmm.
That's in cultures where it's done at a much younger age.
Right.
And my situation being different, Bhante said, well, we don't have to ask your mother, but your kids need to give their approval. So he talked to them, and they had met him over the year, but he talked to them and made sure it was okay with them, and he officially got their approval for it. So
you were living as a single mom?
Yes.
For quite some time.
Yes, since the kids were in first and third grade, I think.
When can you talk a little bit about? You mentioned that you started in some 12-step
mm-hmm.
program work somewhere along the way? I would assume was that prior to your divorce?
Yes, prior to my divorce, and then through my divorce, and then actually I was in a 12-step group up until I started going to meditation in Milwaukee, and that was, it just became a schedule conflict.
Mm-hmm.
So I kept a sponsor after that, and still we go to retreats and go to different 12-step functions that I could. But I ended up with a job I had where I had to go to night meetings and then trying to make it to Milwaukee. You know, my involvement with that 12-step group. I think, too, I had always had trouble, not trouble, I had always had to really work hard with the 12-step group, with the, with some, you know, the higher power concept. And one group I was in, and my sponsor at the time, who I did a lot of work with, and we went through all the steps, but it was a very Christian-focused 12-step group. And I had already made that, you know, I was in the process of making that transition and trying to figure out what my higher power, who my higher power was.
Right, right.
So the transition.
Well, kind of, you were keeping a sponsor, doing some things, but you more and more schedule-wise had gone towards the meditation in Milwaukee.
Right, and I think that was answering some of the questions that I had, too, about finding a higher power and what that was for me.
Yeah.
And the, and it was a better fit.
Yeah.
And I found and have always found there are a lot of 12-step folks in Buddhist groups. So it's a very comfortable language to speak, and it's a very comfortable way to relate to people. And it feels like they're looking for the same things.
Yeah, I love that people, there is the freedom to find, you know, your higher power as you understand that higher power. Maybe that would bring an interesting question. Again, one of those that's not on the sheet. But what would you say if I were to ask you how you would describe your higher power?
Well, I think, and this changes all the time, but for me, it would be the Dhamma that we talked about, meaning the truth. And I think the Buddha kind of got it. I think he really, what he found and what he was looking for was truth that made a lot of sense to me. It felt right. It felt like missing pieces, or it felt like a way that put everything together in a way I could have a way that gave me confidence. So in Buddhism, we don't talk about faith, or we will talk about faith, but what we are talking about more is a confidence in what we're doing, a confidence in the direction we're going. And I think it's a combination of the truth and the teachings that we can read about and hear about, but we're also, through our own meditation practice, we are experiencing those truths for ourselves. So the confidence we have is what keeps us on that path. Like, okay, I can read about this teaching or hear someone talk about it, but I know from my own practice that that's true. It rings true, it's true in everything that I experience. And so that's the confidence I have in that path. So I think those teachings are what gives me the that's what I think of as my higher power.
I see. Yeah, and you had to find that in your way. I mean, when you think about it, that's a long way from fundamental Christianity.
Yes,
that's a long haul. But
right,
but and it fits with what, you know, the focus of what we in very very much in terms of what we wanted to talk about is your journey. You know, because I mean everybody has their own. I guess it's easier if you walk into a church and it fits with your beliefs and then
you
you're done
stick
and you've got
with
a
it,
definition
right?
and you're off you go. But I don't really know that it's that way
for too many people. Right.
So I think that's why it's so helpful to have someone like you be able to articulate what your journey was.
Mm.
Because I think that's helpful to people to hear. That,
I do think people can relate to it, because people will often say to me, you know, there's parts of my story that are their story too.
Mm-hmm.
And it's good to hear someone with the same story.
Yeah, it's reassuring that
yeah.
you're not alone. You know?
Yes.
Or maybe it's okay, maybe even part of it is that it's okay to be confused.
Yes.
I don't know about you, but I
think that's true,
yeah.
that it's okay to have that kind of journey that looks a little crazy sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's like a requirement?
Maybe to be Buddhist in this.
Oh, I looked under my hand.
Yeah, too.
Yeah. If you could video this, that would be. It would be. Yeah. What is that? Okay. Sorry.
I think that's a good point, though. I connect with that personally too. That there is more than one path, and you know, and I think sometimes that can be an obstacle to people that,
mm-hmm.
that maybe feel that calling but don't quite know where to go.
Right. And I think that's why a lot of people who have had that same kind of path are attracted to the Buddhist teachings,
mm-hmm.
because one of the first things someone will say is, no one's asking you to give up a spiritual path that you're on. We're not asking you to join anything or to become part of this group. It's for most people, it's like a supplementary part of your spiritual path, whatever it is.
It's a way of thought or a way of being that you can add to.
You can add to. And the practice of meditation can be added to the practice of prayer and contemplation. And, you know, it can all be part of that same spiritual path. So there, in any group of, at a Buddhist meditation, there may be just a handful of people who would identify themselves as a Buddhist.
Mm-hmm.
And the other people would say, this fits in really well with the 12-step program mm-hmm. I'm in, or with my church, or with my...
Yeah, you mentioned that you find a lot of 12-step people coming
yes.
into this temple in particular, or in general?
Well, I think I certainly found that in Milwaukee at the Shambhala right. Center, which was more of a Tibetan tradition.
Yeah.
And I think if you pick up any Buddhist writing, there are several books now, and there are groups like Dhamma Punks who actually are really, they base their teachings of the Buddhist teachings on the 12-step. They integrate the 12 steps in the Buddhist teachings.
Oh, okay.
They specifically work with people in recovery. So I think all Buddhist groups have had, since they first came to this country, a big population of 12-step people.
And I frankly think that there's plenty of people out there. I don't know what you think about this, but I think there's plenty of people, 12-step people in particular, who wouldn't identify themselves so much with the Christian tradition, but since that's the majority of people here in this country do,
mm-hmm.
And people who are, you know, they feel a little confined by that,
right?
And this is a way maybe to explore something outside of that.
Yes.
Yeah.
And add it to their 12-step program. It
yeah.
may help them answer some of those questions that they can't with the specific group that they're with.
Well, I think it's a great message to hear that this isn't a replacement for, this is an addition to
right.
things that you're doing. You can add meditation to anything.
Right.
And that's, I don't know, you know, if that's common, I don't know if that's common knowledge, you know.
Well, it may not be, because there are a lot of people who think if someone in their family goes to a Buddhist temple that they're changing their religion.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
that's really not the case.
Can you talk a little bit about how you see Buddhism and the 12 steps being compatible?
Well, I think I like the idea of surrender. And I think in Buddhism, that's what we're always trying, when we're practicing meditation, I think what we're always talking about is letting go and relaxing.
Mm-hmm.
and letting go of our thoughts, letting go of the tension that we carry around. And to me, for me, that's I can connect that to the concept of surrendering.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not trying to fix things. We're not trying to be a fixer.
Mm-hmm.
We're not trying to judge or control.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I think we're trying to work with our minds and let go of our kind of compulsive needs to think that we can think through every situation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I relate to that concept. And then I think doing the fearless moral inventory,
mm-hmm.
I think we're doing that all the time when we sit with ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And we're doing it without thinking, okay, I did this bad thing, this bad thing, this bad thing. We're allowing ourselves to sit in silence and let go of all that mental processing we do with everything and be with ourselves.
Mm-hmm. So it's a non-judgmental way of taking the inventory. Or it's not really taking an inventory, it's just allowing things.
Allowing things.
Yeah.
And I think we're always working with finding our own basic goodness,
mm-hmm.
and letting those things that are not so good, that have become our habits, our
mm-hmm.
habitual
mm-hmm.
patterns of behavior, we're able to see those more clearly and just let go of them.
Mm-hmm.
But we're always working with the idea that our essence is basic goodness.
Mm-hmm.
And so that other stuff is just stuck onto us through this lifetime.
Yeah, there's a, like a carrying around a bag of rocks.
Exactly.
Let go of the rocks.
Just let them go.
Yeah.
Right. You don't need to be dragging that around.
Right.
And I think of Velcro, like we're kind of Velcro, and we just let stuff stick to us. But we can let go of that.
Yeah. So there's actually, so all the way from surrender,
mm-hmm.
which is pretty much a fundamental concept of the 12 steps, through the letting go process, the third step, the coming to believe, and the third step, and then the inventory steps, and then the sixth and seventh step, which are the letting go of the bag of rocks steps. And then, of course, the next steps are the connecting with the rest of the human race and the amends and the
mm-hmm.
cleaning up the messes.
Cleaning it up
steps.
And then maintaining that.
And then maintaining it, yeah.
And I think we do that through our practice, too. One, we do develop a community of people
mm-hmm.
to help us maintain that way of thinking and that way of being,
mm-hmm.
and you know, we're always kind of turning more and more towards that, what we call in Buddhism, wholesome lifestyle,
mm-hmm.
which is that instead of negative thinking, you know, a different way of thinking and a different way of relating.
How does the community help with that? Just the support of thinking the same thinking, or is there actually a process of connecting with people, or how does that work?
I think it works more for a lot of people, coming together to practice meditation is the way people get started,
mm-hmm.
and the way they actually learn the discipline of sitting. And you'll hear people say all the time, it's too hard for me to do it at home.
Mm.
It's too noisy.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. I'm too distracted.
Yes.
I can't sit for very long. And so, one, when you provide a spot where you've got either a quiet place to come or you're sitting with a group of people, it's always easier. It's all, you know, you, and then little by little you're learning that you're being trained in being able to sit.
Mm.
Then you can sit for 30 minutes and you can do it and actually bring your breath back, your attention back to your breath a
mm-hmm.
few times at least.
Mm-hmm.
So that encourages people that they to be able to do it on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And then people just casually, you know, become interested in activities that might be going on, so they get more involved and meet people that way. There isn't any special agenda or program to do that, but it's more being around other people. So if there was something you were dealing with and you wanted advice, this
mm-hmm.
might be the group of people you would want to go to.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and the same way, I think, in a 12-step group, you have your sponsor, you have the other people in your group, you know those people will see through your, you know, your BS. They'll see through, you know those people know what the real issue, they'll see through more quickly to the real issue. And so that's the same with the Sangha.
And I would imagine that people that are here are seekers of the truth.
I think so.
And so
they may come because they want to lower their blood pressure, or their doctors recommended it, or they may come for a lot of other reasons. But if they stay with it, I think people also are drawn to the teachings and the truth.
What happens when you can? What happens, I guess, emotionally or spiritually, when maybe it's one or the other or both, when you can sit for 30 minutes or 50 minutes, when you can reach that quietness? What happens?
Well, I think it's always it's never, there's never an end point. So it's always a process. You may be able right away to sit for 30 minutes very quietly and feel really happy about that. And then maybe the next week you can't sit for a minute. So it's never
it's not a goal-oriented.
No, it's not a goal-oriented path, and it's not we always tell people to just let go of their expectations, because people will assume, okay, when I can sit for 30 minutes without wiggling, then something wonderful will happen. And that just means you can sit for 30 minutes without wiggling.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
You don't get a gold star or a certificate or anything.
Not at all, or a title. And so even people who have been meditating 30, 40 years, they'll say they have times when it's difficult to even sit. Mm-hmm. And we have monkey mind, which is that, you know, our mind's just going off after every little spot of dust in the air. We have that all the time. So what we might come to expect is, when we see ourselves really bouncing all over the place, we see it sooner. We may see that faster and notice that when we get that way, our bodies feel bad, we have tension, we say things that we wish we hadn't said. You know, we feel physically and emotionally like we're losing control, and we begin to connect it with that monkey mind. So we begin to know, I really need to sit. I need to be quiet. I need to get back to what I know. And so we're never able to completely reach that point until we've reached enlightenment. But we don't have that as a goal. The goal is really, I want to be able to know what's going on with my mind and work with it, and then be able to see the signs in my body that tell me maybe things are not going so well, or this tension might be connected to a thought I keep having about a certain situation. So we're learning a lot of things just from knowing our bodies better. And we can do that by the practice of meditation. That's sitting with ourselves.
Yeah, I can see that. One of the things in that I was thinking about here as you were explaining it, is that there's a separation of self and mind, that I'm not my mind. And,
right.
And there's a phrase in the 12-step programs that you might be familiar with, and that is, we've got a disease in which our brains are trying to kill us.
that's exactly right.
So this is kind of the antidote for self-destruction,
right?
In some respects, because if you think you're your mind and you're only connected to that, and it's telling you things
that
are self-destructive, off you go.
There you go.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So this would be
this is a way to look at that and start seeing, okay, my mind is doing its own thing. It's totally separate from what I want it to be doing, and I can't completely shut it down, I can't completely control it, but I can learn, okay, that's just a thought, that's nothing more than a thought.
Mm-hmm.
And I can sit and watch that thought come and not have to act on it, watch it stay there for a while, not have to act on it, and then watch it go.
Mm-hmm.
So we're just learning that thoughts are thoughts, and they are not who we are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the practice of meditation itself is a strategy for letting the thought go.
Yeah, I think that's a very clear antidote for,
right.
for, you know, because there's people that have lots of thoughts and follow them all the time. And
right.
Some of those aren't, you know, don't take us in really good places. So, and I can see the connection between that. One of the things we talked about was a couple of things. How do you handle skepticism about your practice, or isn't that an experience that you have?
I have a lot of that experience when I go home for a visit. This is for me personally. For me, it's very important that I don't try to proselytize or tell people.
Mm-hmm.
People will ask and may want to know, and they may be interested in what the practice does for me. But if someone's skeptical about it, that's fine. I was skeptical about it too before mm-hmm. I showed myself that it worked.
Mm-hmm.
So I think skepticism is no problem with
maybe
that.
Maybe skepticism is a step to understanding.
Well, I think so, because if they're skeptical, they may have good questions, they may have some ideas of their own that it would be valuable to listen to.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't threaten me in any way. You know, it's not anything, it's not, that doesn't belong to me. That's their skepticism, it's not mine.
So. Mm-hmm. That's a separate thing.
Yeah.
So, and this is another thing that we talked about a little bit before we started, but how would you describe yourself? And we threw this out, and your response was so interesting, I think it's worth talking about a little bit. The choices I gave you in my limited way were, would you consider yourself a religious person, a spiritual person, a recovering person? How would you describe yourself?
I said it depends on the day or what I had just done. So
right.
Maybe it might be a nun, it might be a mom. It might be, I can't even remember what the other one was.
You said sister?
Oh, a sister, a daughter?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think it's very, for me anyway, it's very important that I wear that title as being a nun, a Buddhist monk. I need to wear that pretty lightly because my being a monastic is just it's my personal choice of how I'm following this path.
Mm-hmm.
So I definitely, my spiritual path is following the teachings that I think are the teachings of the Buddha and developing my meditation practice. But my choice to be a monk to do it is just, it's just a personal decision. It doesn't make me any different from anybody else. Although my head, you know, don't have hair and I wear a robe.
Yeah, you're not shaved and you wear a robe, but that, besides that.
But other than that.
You're just a regular person.
Yeah.
But you don't always, I mean, you always have your head shaved, that you can't change. But
right.
You don't always wear robes, you said.
Right, there sometimes. Are times when I will wear regular clothes,
mm-hmm.
which is unusual in Asian countries, you wouldn't see that. But there might be certain things that I'm going to do or certain things I'm involved in where I may wear.
And you work also. You do some outside work outside the temple?
I do. I do some part-time work right
mm-hmm.
now.
Okay.
So, and before, when I first became a nun, I was teaching in a prison,
mm-hmm.
and I couldn't wear robes there just because of the separation of church and state, but the safety issue of...
Right, concealed weapons or whatever,
yeah.
or contraband.
And, right.
Yeah.
So. And that was okay. That was something that's between my teacher and myself.
Mm-hmm.
And Bhante Sujata who ordained me as my teacher, and he's the person I went to, and he said, no, that's good work. Being a teacher is good work. And when he began, came and started Blue Lotus, he had to work in a, he worked in a job as a caretaker at mm-hmm. the Pioneer Center.
Oh, okay.
And so he knew the realities are that we have to support ourselves as monastics in this mm-hmm. country.
And you mentioned you're not, and Buddhist nuns don't marry.
Right. That was a requirement, is you have to be celibate.
Mm-hmm.
So it's fine that I was divorced. That was not an mm-hmm. issue at all.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as I'm a nun, I can't have a relationship or be
right.
married.
I see. Okay, because I know that that's something that people would wonder, you know, are Buddhist nuns the same as, you know, a Catholic nun or a whatever?
Right. It's monks, the same rules apply for monks, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some schools in Buddhism, some, there's some in Zen and in some Tibetan
mm-hmm.
Lineages. There are teachers who can marry and have mm-hmm. families. So it is not the same with all. So mm-hmm. it is confusing sometimes for
but
people.
But not in your tradition.
In Theravada tradition.
Not, that's not it.
It's just straight, it's just yeah.
easy to answer.
Easy.
So your answer to the question basically is you would say if we had to choose religious, spiritual, or recovering, it would be none of the above. You're what you are yeah. on the day that I asked.
Yeah, I am what I am.
How about
right?
today? What are you today?
Today is probably Buddhist Nun Day.
Because, okay.
Yeah.
Good.
I have.
Because that's who I was hoping to interview.
Yeah. those are the days that life is best for me, is smoothest.
Yeah.
Because it feels like there's more just continuity in my yeah. life and my day. And so I'll end the day today. I have a meditation class in mm-hmm. Wisconsin tonight
mm-hmm.
and have a couple of other things this afternoon. So it's easier that way. But when it's a day where there's dealing with the auto mechanic and dealing with, mm-hmm. say, an issue, one of my kids are adults, but they're still my kids, dealing with something that they want some help with or I mean, those are, it's really difficult to be a layperson.
Yeah. that's a mom day or a auto
yeah.
mechanic dealing with day. Or
right. Or my mom, who's still in Houston, mm-hmm. has some medical issues coming up, you know, mm-hmm. deciding if I'm going to fly to Houston or what, mm-hmm. what I'm going to do. So it's I really understand why the ideal role for a monastic is to be a little bit separate from that. But that would seem like a luxury that we don't have in this country.
Yeah.
And personally, yeah. I wouldn't want to be separated from the family that I have. So it works for me.
Yeah. I see how it would be difficult. On the other hand, it fits really well with the one day at a time concept that we talk
exactly.
about. It's, you know, one moment at a time in some respects.
Exactly.
You're not defining yourself by what you do, what you, you know, we're not saying this is what you are, we're looking at what you're doing in the moment.
And yeah. of course, for anyone, the difficulties of any spiritual practice, it's what you do when you're not sitting on the cushion or
right.
in the church building, or it's when you're dealing with all those other things. So I think that for the monastics here at Blue Lotus and for myself, the fact that we're dealing with the real world a lot just makes us more sensitive to the kind of issues that everyone has to deal with.
Yeah, I see how that...
Whether it's paying your rent, paying your bills,
sure.
you know, all of that, those are real issues for all of us.
You're in it. If I could ask you, you know, you've been through quite a few transitions over a period of time from the fundamental tradition to a less fundamental church to in some 12-step work and into the Buddha, into meditation and then into the Buddhist tradition and then into your, you know, now
right.
being ordained.
Right.
If you could give people who are listening some either advice or how did you do it? How did that happen? How did you survive that radical change? And how would you recommend that people? What would you tell them if they're in the journey? If they're somewhere in the journey and they're confused or struggling?
We're always confused and feel like we're struggling. I think for me, I think I must have been really open to allowing a lot of change to come into my life. I don't know why I was, or I don't know what were the causes of that, but change was just as hard for me each time as it would be for anybody else. But mm-hmm. I think I had the belief that there was something bigger or another adventure. When I had my kids, I really didn't think 2 years before I had my daughter, I would have thought I would never have kids.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the thing to do, though, is to really embrace each of those phases.
Mm-hmm.
So I loved having my children mm-hmm. and having a family, and that was, I think, that's an experience. I consider my kids my best teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And they're what grounded me for a while, you know, in a certain location, in
mm-hmm.
a certain path.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the only thing I would not like would be to look back and have regrets about those different phases in my life. And
you
think, oh, I have, you know, I always think, I think I have regrets that my children had to come from a divorced family.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I think, and that's I think every single mother I have ever talked mm-hmm. to who's been through a divorce feels that way.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's just something we would rather our children didn't have to experience that.
Right.
No matter how wonderful their lives turn out, it just seems like, oh, if only we could have done that differently.
Right.
And we can't, you know, we also know at the same right. time we couldn't have. But I think if we embrace each of those phases, and then we can let them go.
Maybe even the regrets?
Well, the regrets especially, because
okay.
I feel like I'll have days where I know those regrets are, I mean, that's just, there's no point in that.
Right.
And those are hard, that's one that's hard for me to let go of. Other things are much easier.
Mm-hmm.
I did the best I could do with whatever that phase
mm-hmm.
was, and then I knew when it was time to move on. Maybe more in spiritual teachings, I kind of had a sense when it was time to move on.
Well, it sounds like that the what you're saying is you're advising people to embrace the process, wherever they are in the process, whatever the process is, whether
right.
it's regrets, whether it's joys,
and be patient with it too. I mean, I think impatience has been a problem for me in my life, and I know that impatience is the thing that causes us to feel like that's when we will have regrets. Is if we
mm.
feel like we have to move too fast or move on to something, and we're not really clear that we're finished with what we're in. I think it's really important to finish an experience.
And you have to have patience to do that.
Right, right. And patience to do the practice. And
well, I feel like we've covered most of what I wanted to ask. Are there any things that you would want to add to what you've said, or any things that you would want to say to...
Well, the only thing I would say is I think this particular situation, having Blue Lotus Temple here
mm-hmm.
and Bhante Sujatha here
mm-hmm.
and the other monks, it is a unique situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people don't realize that sometimes until they come here.
Mm-hmm.
It's so unusual to have a Buddhist temple that's made up of Westerners.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of Buddhist temples in this country, but they're primarily the different ethnic communities.
Yeah.
So people may not even speak English.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole idea of having a Buddhist teacher with that really firm grounding that Bhante Sujatha and the other monks do, having them here speaking English, working with Westerners, it's like this is a pretty amazing opportunity. It was for me. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have taken this path if it hadn't been for Bhante Sujata. It's such an amazing, what a coincidence. I'm from Texas, and I ended up living
in Wisconsin.
Accidentally in Wisconsin.
Right.
And then found my teacher here. Mm-hmm. It's just, how does that happen?
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. It's a beautiful coincidence or a beautiful opportunity
and a great resource for everybody, but especially those, you know, for the listeners of this show who are what we would describe as recovering people,
right,
for the most part. And you described very well how that fits and what a great resource it would be for,
right,
them to do. So I thank you for taking the time to talk and explaining things. And
well, thank you. It was my pleasure.